This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
This week's episode of Screen Talk is sponsored by On the Record. Described by The Guardian as a landmark, no documentary has so powerfully connected the causes of Me Too and Black Lives Matter. On the Record presents the stories of Drew Dixon, Sherry Scherer, and Sil-Lai Abrams as they grapple with their decision to become one of the first black women in the wake of Me Too to publicly accuse hip-hop mogul Russell Simmons of sexual assault. From filmmakers Kirby Dick and Amy Ziering, whose body of work has covered sexual assault in the military with The Invisible War, college campuses with The Hunting Ground, and now the music industry. On the Record dives into the ways black women are too often ignored when alleging sexual assault and the cultural forces that pressure them into silence. For your consideration, On the Record is now streaming only on HBO Max. Welcome to Screen Talk, IndieWire's weekly movie podcast. I'm Eric Gunn, the executive editor and chief critic, joined as always by Ann Thompson, our editor at large, and I'm in the middle of a puddle of snow here in New York. How's the sunshine out in Los Angeles?
No complaints. It's balmy. I think we're in the 60s.
It's the season. Some things don't change, though. This is a strange time for us to be recording because we usually record right before the end of the week on a Thursday, and we're kind of caught right before the holidays and the end of the year, but then after all this other stuff has happened, so we're sort of, we have a lot to talk through, but also a lot to anticipate right now, because by the time a lot of people hear this podcast, the New York Film Critics Circle will have voted over the weekend, the Los Angeles critics will vote. So we'll have that new piece of information that'll contribute to award season per usual. But we can't totally get into all of that right now, except to sort of speculate about what seems likely to happen in those situations. And I suppose one starting point would be IndieWire's critic survey, which did its 15th edition this past week, simply because a lot of the critics who vote in both of those groups also vote in the survey, 221 people.
All right. So I have a question for you on that. Where do you get all those people from and who are they? That's a lot of people, 230.
I will say,
the Critics' Choice group is about that size, but it's a different group entirely.
So the longish answer, which I think is valuable, is to explain in terms of the history of this survey, which was originally, there was a Village Voice year-end film survey that went away and IndieWire took it over. And then at a certain point, the Village Voice survey came back and IndieWire kept going. But when it was taken over, at that time, the film editor of the Village Voice, who had been sort of booted by the new management, Dennis Lim, he kind of helped us organize it that year. So a lot of the initial foundation of emails came from the Village Voice survey.
So was it a very international group or more American?
No. And so over the years, what's happened is that the scope of the survey has grown as we've started to look to ways of sort of expanding beyond our initial network. And so we have multiple docs with breakdowns of people in different countries and you know, sort of making sure that we can be as representative as possible of different aspects of the film critic community. So as much as it's important to get the trade critics and the newspaper critics who are willing to do it, not the New York Times because they have rules, but a lot of the other dailies and so forth, they do that. But we also want to get people from, you know, influential blogs and so forth. So it's a pretty good representation, I would say, overall. But no, at the end of the day, it's also contingent on people to do the survey. So we invite a lot of people. Not everybody always does it.
So if I'm remembering correctly, because I remember sending you, I would always send you the top newspaper critics and magazine critics, as because you were all, it felt for a long time like you were favoring online critics in this survey. But would you say, if you had to do a demo on this, largely male, largely white male, and younger than the most powerful media film critics?
No, I don't think that's accurate at all. In fact, I don't have the exact numbers because there's a difference between the number of people we invite and those who participate, but there is a substantial number of women, at the very least, I could tell you a substantial number of women who vote. I don't know if it's a majority or not, because we haven't crunched the numbers in terms of who actually participated, but we do track that. We started tracking that a few years ago, and it's something that's a part of the conversation. In terms of, are they mostly younger? I mean, I can tell you people like Todd McCarthy and Amy Taubin certainly voted. So, you know, I do sometimes remind people, and there's a bit of a hands-on process that I think is valuable.
No, you're very good about that. You reminded me. So I did participate.
And I think, look, a lot of these surveys don't exist anymore. It's really valuable in some ways to, I think, reach out to as many people as possible to get them to vote, because the more people you get, the more you get a sense of the scope of films that have critical support. That's why we publish the top 50. Because you go through that top 50, and it's fascinating to see which films got
it's so important. It's so important. I was reminded of all sorts of things that I still need to see and that I've missed. And I look forward over the holidays to doing a lot of catching up. But if you were to say, if you were to guess what the difference between this group and the New York Film Critics group taste, if what each right. group represents.
Yeah, I mean, well, so if we're going to look at New York Film Critics Group as sort of a subset of the critic survey, because a lot of the members of there's somewhere close to 50 members of the New York Film Critics Group. It's larger
than
ever
before. It's gotten much bigger. Yeah,
it has, and we pushed for that when I was a member, because I wanted to make sure people understood the process through which you could become a member if you were qualified. And I think it's probably a good number right now. And what's significant about it, I think, is that these are very active, informed voters. So they do think about what has consensus and whether or not voting for something that has no chance makes sense, or do you vote for the thing you would be more okay with? So I don't know. I mean, if you look at let's say that the critics survey is a fairly good indicator of some of the films that have support from the New York Film Critics Group. There was a really close number one and number two in our critic survey, closer than I can ever remember.
Nomadland.
It was Nomadland in number one, just a hair above Never Rarely, Sometimes Always. And
I was surprised that did as well as it did. And I'm glad because it's on my top 10, and I love you and I both put that on our top 10s.
Yeah, not only did it do well, it got Never Rarely was on more ballots than Nomadland. But because it's a ranked system, you do a top 10 list. Nomadland was in more number one slots. So that shows you just how close those two are. And I do think that those are strong possibilities. And First Cow, which was number three.
Those are all going to do well with the New York Film Critics. And I would hope Minari, I have to keep saying it more carefully, Minari will do well.
Minari, I mean, I think all, you know, who knows, maybe for performance. I mean, I also think people want to divide and conquer, you know, spread the love, that kind of thing. Usually, I don't know exactly how it's going to be. Usually, best films voted on first, so people have that information and it can sort of help inform the voting process. Look, if a film is deserving of sweeping, it maybe it'll sweep. But this just doesn't feel like that kind of year. There's just a lot of options. In spite of everything, there's a lot of options, which I think is great. And does that mean that Nomadland still is the front runner? I mean, probably, but I'll be curious to see how this trickles down in the weeks.
No, it could be hurting Nomadland now. If it's perceived as the front runner, if it's perceived as the big gorilla in the room, that's Searchlight. They're fine. They're going to do great. You know, that could hurt it, especially with New York Film Critics. I would suggest. I bet they give it some, you know, you guys get to do, you know, actress,
cinematography,
director, performances, and all that.
Oh yeah. Yeah, and critics really like this movie. I mean, let's be clear.
No question. It's deserving. It's wonderful. We both put it on our list as well.
It is, yeah. I mean, honestly, it's like if it's Nomadland versus Chicago 7 for Best Picture or something of that magnitude, which one is going to be seen as sort of the more powerful entity? You know, I mean, Nomadland, I think in general, seems to present itself as a kind of underdog sort of movie. So it would have to be really, really like sweeping everything in it to a ridiculous degree for people to get kind of sick of celebrating it.
I'm sort of curious how the Netflix of it all plays out with the critics, because, and also in terms later on with the Academy, in terms of, there's still a perception that, you know, you and I both saw, at least I did, I saw Nomadland at a drive-in in a theatrical setting. And I keep wondering, I think they did that on purpose. I think it was smart. A lot of people saw it at the Telluride screening in LA. It's just an interesting year with so much being consumed in the home. We'll see what happens. I both saw Tenet this week.
Yeah. Oh boy. I mean, talking about seeing things on a big screen and whether or not they're worth it, I don't know if this would have salvaged anything for me, to be honest with you. I was quite disappointed, even based on expectations from what had been out there about this movie not being one of Nolan's best. I actually thought it was his worst. It's just a really dull movie that doesn't warrant.
It's not about anything.
There's no subtext.
There's no subtext.
I suspect, you know, when Nolan tends to have an idea, you know, maybe rooted in science, and then sort of reverse engineers these sophisticated narratives. And even in something like Interstellar, which I think is sort of underappreciated to some degree, what you end up having is something that's like really complex at its core, and then varying degrees of characterizations that are sometimes not as great as the underlying idea, but there's still a lot going on there. And I think what happened here was there's some really sophisticated machinery involving time travel. But
and he got caught up in it, and he thought it was more interesting than it actually was. It doesn't matter.
The problem is like the boring. Plot is, even if you understand the plot, and I'm pretty sure I understood what happened in this movie overall, it's just kind of cheesy and actually derivative. I mean, I could name, I was like, oh, that's like a Terminator subplot or whatever. You know, it's just like stuff that I've seen before.
But he didn't even bother to make the characters interesting. I mean, and it isn't the actor's fault. They were as good as they could possibly be, but the dialogue was inane. There was some dialogue in this movie where I was like, whoa, that is really bad.
Somebody needed to step in and say, I mean, honestly, he's not a bad director. And visually, there are some good ideas. So
there's
why not
get
somebody to write it?
Fabulous set pieces. These people, I'm going to say this. I have a great deal of respect for Christopher Nolan. It relates in a way to the Tom Cruise thing that happened this week. It's not dissimilar. The role that Nolan has taken on at Warner Brothers, because he is the master of so many huge hits, because he keeps consistently delivering big budget tent poles that do really well and earn the studio a lot of money, they give him a lot of power, and they kowtow to him. And they did in this case. They allowed this movie Tenet to go out theatrically at a time when it really wasn't a good idea. And it did okay, given all the odds, all the different problems with COVID in Europe. And it also may have been a disappointment anyway, given what it is.
This confirmed what I'd been sort of hinting at based on the response, which is that you can only sort of get around a stinker so much in certain cases. And with a movie like this, as much as marketing dollars and hype can probably work in its favor, if this was an Inception level experience in which you come out of it talking about dynamic sequences, the sophisticated machinery of the plot, lots to unravel, there would have been a word of mouth factor one way or another. Tenet didn't give people a reason to be excited to go to the movies again. Just its very existence was not enough.
That said, it is the kind of movie that is best seen on a big screen with the best sound. And the sound, Oscar prognosticator Ann Thompson says, this will not get a sound nomination. It is so murky. He has different ears from everyone else. He doesn't listen to his sound people, and he mixes it in a way that makes it very difficult to hear the dialogue.
When you have it on, when you have the Blu-ray, you can put subtitles.
I put it
on
Blu-ray, I still couldn't understand. I mean, I was watching it in a very high level, gorgeous screen in my living room, good analog speakers that I have, you know.
Well, but the problem that I discovered was that if you turn the subtitles on, it's not doing him any favors, because then you pay more attention.
You see
attention
how inane they are.
Yeah, the dialogue's not very good. This isn't the end. It's only the beginning. Like
it's
stuff like
so
that
silly.
Where you're just like, just nix that, you know. It's just so obvious that there's moments in that movie that did need to be there. So I have to tell you, I did a SAG Q&A with Gary Oldman last weekend on Zoom, obviously, and he was in London shooting some Apple series, and he told this great story about he was being driven home, and he passed a theater in London that was showing Mank, and asked them if they could stop, and he went to the ushers and asked if he could pop in, and he watched 10 minutes of Mank on a big screen. And he was like, David Fincher's been robbed of being able to talk about that aspect of that movie. And whatever you think about Mank, that's a gorgeous
film. No, I wish I'd seen it in a film, in a theater. Yeah, Are you kidding? I want to see these films as they're meant to be seen. I want to see them in all their glory with all the bell. Think about it. Think about all the crafts people. Think about the meticulousness of David Fincher and Christopher Nolan.
That is
Nolan.
A movie that needed
how
the theatrical.
They are perfectionists. Yeah. They take take after take after. I talked to Gary Oldman this week also. I had a wonderful phone conversation with him.
Making the rounds.
And I really enjoyed, you know, his you know, he explained the multiple takes. He explained how why that's done that way and what it's about and how he handles it, how he rolls with it. And it's about getting every single aspect of the entire long sequence with all the different shots and all the different reactions and everything, and having your performance is okay, but we got to get everything in the picture perfect. Look, if the sound and the Nolan, but if the sound and the cinematography and the production design and the costume design, all these artists are working at their top capacity, and you have to watch it on a small screen in your living room, it's not the way it should be.
Yeah, so bottom line, the indulgent auteur experience actually worth investing in of 2020 is David Fincher's, not Christopher Nolan's. I mean, that's a very interesting distinction, I think, in terms of what they're offering.
I would suggest that Mank has its pleasures and its delights, and it's also structurally, in terms of the script and the story and how it unfolds, not entirely satisfying.
Well, I watched it twice in a very short period of time, and it was very sad.
I've seen it twice, too. I watched it twice, too. And I watched it carefully the second time to see what worked and what didn't work. And my belief is that in the second half of Mank, when you get into the Upton Sinclair, you lose a lot of steam. And he's staying in that Victorville house for too long. And you're kind of wondering why. And the best stuff in the movie is the Hollywood stuff, the stuff between him and Marion Davies and Amanda Seyfried.
Well, some of that happens later. And I did enjoy the wine came up with the fish, that whole kind of everything.
That's the sequence where he did the 100 takes.
Yeah. I mean, I think that it, on some level, it is a cerebral experience more than a lot of people might be willing to sort of settle in for, but it does make you really think, and it forces you to engage with what it's doing on many levels at once. I know it's no Borat, but nothing is. So.
You know, but there is a meme against Fincher, which is that he's cold and that he's involved. The word on the street that sticks to a sticky thing is what I mean by a meme. It's a thing.
Well, yeah,
repeats.
It's like a. It's just, it, yeah, but
that's
I mean,
what I mean.
The meme associated with Mank, memes generally these days are like stupid things that are repeated on the internet indefinitely, and it's just that the word Mank is
doesn't
funny.
Have to be a stupid thing repeated on the internet. It can be a sticky, destructive thing repeated inside the Academy. I think that's a meme too.
Well, it's not the these days when you say meme, you mean internet meme, and
not necessarily.
Well, the internet meme with Mank has also probably been an issue for it, because like I've seen weird stuff where like people dress up the one sheet as a Marvel movie, or like they like to use the word, like replacing it in famous sayings and stuff. It's just being mocked in a very strange kind of superficial way.
Let me put Mank in another context. You and I both are huge. We're cinephiles, and we love all of this stuff, and we live for it. I went to NYU Cinema Studies and studied Orson Welles. I mean, I love all this stuff. So I think my expectations were really, really high. And so there's some perfect version of this that I want that I didn't get. I don't know what it was, but it wasn't what I wanted.
Let's take that description and apply it to the next topic of conversation this week, which is Sundance, because expectations I think we're all over the place for the kinds of films that could go to Sundance this year, what this lineup was going to look like in a year when, you know, it seems like people are wary of virtual festivals and we don't really know what's available, who's waiting and so forth. We got this lineup early, had a lot of time to go through it. The two of us spoke with the heads of the festival, Tabitha Jackson and Kim Yutani.
And there's a lot to talk about.
Yeah, I have to tell you, I felt like I was excited about a Sundance lineup like I would in any other year, in the sense that the movies that I tend to get excited about are in the next section, or they're from first-time filmmakers, or the ones that are sort of, they're a little edgier maybe. And
during
and
this conversation, I'm going to share this because I think maybe you'll be amused. Maybe the folks listening will be amused. But it's like Anne and Eric were bad cop and good cop, and Eric was.
Let me be clear. Anne called herself the bad cop at the start.
I know. No, Eric set me up. Eric said, "Anne, you do all the business questions, and I'll do the I love independent cinema questions." And they were like, "You're gonna love this movie, Eric. You're gonna love that movie, you know." And I was like, I was smiling. Of course.
Well, because
of course you are.
I love movies too. It's not a question of that. I think it's more like there are certain films that I'm tracking that probably won't be especially attractive to buyers, aren't necessarily going to have, you know, awards potential, or if they do, it'll be a surprise and it'll take a long time to get to that conversation. But they're films that are exciting for aesthetic reasons, and on some level, a festival being a platform for that is still really important in our culture. And so that's what I want to be able to pay attention to.
And you should. Otherwise, and that's your job. And IndieWire is going to be all over this festival looking for discoveries and looking for talent and looking for new people to write about and exciting movies to write about. And we're going to do it up the wazoo. The side effect of the pandemic and the virtual festival is that some of these movies won't get picked up. Okay, yeah, that's the problem.
Well, it's a real question of who would buy a movie.
And a lot of the distributors who have movies, who could have brought them to Sundance, chose to sit it out and wait because they don't know when the movies are going to open. I applaud Neon for having the guts to bring Night of Kings and the new Ben Wheatley movie, which is about a virus, to Sundance. But a lot of distributors are sitting it out. A lot of the big
Zero
documentary
A24.
Filmmakers.
No A24, obviously no Netflix. We expected that. But I mean, people who have done well at Sundance in the past don't seem to be.
Netflix had a movie in and they were considering letting it play there, and they chose to sit it out.
Well, it's hard to see how they stand to benefit. And honestly, it's like that extra noise. When I'm at Sundance, a movie that is coming out in a couple of weeks is just fundamentally less attractive to me. I think that there is real value in introducing a bunch of new films to the market through Sundance that will need media to pay attention to them.
Absolutely.
And hopefully more will.
And it's the lifeblood of the industry. And believe me, the talent agents and the casting agents and the people who are looking for new directors to represent this is like the nutrition that feeds our industry. It is one of the most important festivals in the world for this reason. And that will still happen. People are still going to look for that.
Let's be clear. There are some films that could be commercial. I mean, you look at some, I don't know yet, but like Rebecca Hall's directorial debut.
Passing is one of the things I'm most interested in.
So it's Tessa Thompson and Ruth Negga in that story of living across race lines in 1929, based on a book.
But it's also her own experience with her mom, who's an opera singer who was biracial. Married to
Peter
Hall.
So people will be looking at that, but there's just tons of other stuff, you know, across the lineup that I think it could be really exciting. I mean, a film like Coda, which has Marley Matlin in a story about the only hearing child in a deaf family, that's one of their opening night films. Like, that sounds like a definite kind of crowd pleaser with a conversation around it.
And then
stuff
Quest
like
Love's debut, Summer of Soul.
He directed a documentary.
This is a great story. It's all about the summer of Woodstock.
Right.
And there was this whole other festival.
The Harlem
that was just
Cultural
as big,
Festival.
Almost. Yeah.
Yeah, the Harlem Cultural Festival. I mean,
that I never heard of, and you never heard of.
No, I know. It sounds fascinating. And Jared Carmichael directed a movie called On the Count of Three, which sounds like a really fun kind of black comedy. And I don't know, there's a movie called John in the Hole, which was in the Cannes selection. So, you know, they selected it, but it didn't obviously play anywhere yet, about a kid and who traps his family in a hole, which obviously sounds very pandemic oriented. And the kid is played by the kid from Captain Fantastic,
who, as you recall, was a real breakout. He's a very good actor.
A little older now, but it's just something about that one. When I saw that it was there, I was like, this could be a really fun movie to talk about at Sundance. Now, at Sundance is a different kind of thing. We're not going to be in the snow. If you have an Oculus headset like me, you might be able to go to their lounge on virtual Main Street. So I encourage people to do that, but outside of that, I mean, I guess you can chat.
New Frontier, they were describing what that is going to be like, and it sounds cool. You don't have to have a VR headset to experience a lot of the stuff. They've created a very fancy new platform for New Frontier. We used to all complain about how we had to stand in line for hours to get into some of these things to experience them. So this might be, there are going to be ways that this is an improvement on sloshing through the snow. And
well, I know a lot of people have said that. I mean, the term that Tabitha Jackson used was slippers instead of snow boots. And I'm sure that people who have to cram their schedules and don't necessarily do well in inclement weather are going to be very happy to have that experience in a more controlled environment.
And we'll be more focused on the movies yet again. But what happened at Toronto, and you and I are accustomed to this, so we're used to it, but it's intense, man, when you've got these movies all lined up and they're all against each other and you have to pick one and you have to see it inside the time frame.
Yeah.
And then there's a Q&A, and do you have time to watch that too, or are you live? And that's a thing to, for them to have mounted, that's expensive and difficult to mount every one of these things live with a live Q&A is a big deal too. But yeah, I think this, it will help to enhance the experience.
I've said this before, but I really think that now is the time for transparency around data, because after something like every time one of these things happens, it's an important test case because it's different from what came before. This is not TIFF. It's not New York. It's not, you know, other virtual festivals. And now it seems like Berlin might be going virtual. So every time they do it, they're doing it their own kind of way. And then they're trying to get things to audiences through various windows of exclusivity that replicate what a festival can do in the virtual space. So we need to be able to learn from that data. So I really hope that Sundance looks at that as an opportunity and tries to explain after we go through this stuff, whether or not this was a successful festival, because we're only going to see it through the prism of being very plugged in industry insiders. I'd love to know how somebody in another state, let's say Alaska, buys tickets to Sundance, or how a buyer who combs through the lineup for Discoveries or a programmer for a regional festival who does the same experiences Sundance, and whether or not they end up having a constructive experience, because you have to satisfy all those different levels in order to maintain the identity.
But the one point I will make gently, because it is Tabitha Jackson's first festival, and she is brilliant and charming, and she's going to be great over the long haul. And Kim Utani is a fabulous programmer. But it's hard to tell whether this pure program was purer than it needed to be, or were they able to balance some of the you know, a couple of titles that might have had a little more sex appeal for the marketplace. I'm not saying that's their job, but there's an element of reality there that would have greased the skids.
Conversely, usually those movies sell for a lot of money at Sundance, and then a few months later we get stories about how they bomb, right? So maybe that never did them any favors in the first place. I mean, honestly, like I don't even remember the titles of most of these movies or studio movies. Like, nobody's talking about Downhill anymore. I mean, I never even got around to it.
It was terrible.
One of those things where it's like, I understand why those movies go to Sundance, but I'm not sure that they usually contribute to what's constructive about
It's hard to know whether there was a real good one that they just didn't get or didn't like, and they were, we have to put in this fabulous international film from over here instead. You know, I don't know. I applaud them, but the usual marketplace is skinny in this situation.
Yeah, and there's just so many unknown factors here, because what even are people going to be looking for? We don't know the full
That's
timeline
part of the issue.
For,
it's true.
For, well, for the vaccine.
We don't know what the value of anything is.
Is our fears as an idea going to start having some relevance in what Anthony Fauci calls the back half of 2021? Or are these all going to be VOD acquisitions? I mean, a lot of these movies might be anyway, just because of the nature of the market, even in a pre-COVID time. But it is, it does open some questions for the bigger ones. Let's say the Rebecca Hall film. What are people going to be demanding for that? That's one of the things we're going to have to learn in the next few weeks, is how are sales agents
Absolutely correct.
That?
Absolutely right, Eric.
So next week, it'll be interesting. We're going to be sort of heading into the end of the year for recording a special issue edition that'll go up right before New Year's. But for the holidays, we'll have a whole bunch of new information with these critics groups. And I'm sure there's going to be some other stuff sort of trickling out there, but I don't think there's anything left for us to see. Do you have any serious blind spots left? I feel like I have that almost like a godlike awareness of everything that's out there. At this point.
I caught up with two things this week. I caught up with the Mauritanian, which is
okay.
Coming
I have
out
not
from
seen that.
STX.
Okay.
Which stars Tahar Rahim and Jodie Foster and
I'm writing
Benedict
it down.
Cumberbatch. And it's a late entry. They've just, you know, I guess there was some debate about whether to open it before the end of the year and make it eligible for the Oscars. They're going for it, and they should go for it. It's actually quite good. Tahar Rahim gives an extraordinary performance, actually, as someone who was accused of being part of the 9/11 plot and was held in jail for like 14 years. Seriously.
Wow. Okay.
And without any accusations really being placed against him. And it's about the legal battle to get him free. And he lives in Berlin. He's a guy who's around and remarkable. And it's directed by Kevin MacDonald, who I've always liked. I think he's a very smart, canny director. You know, it's a BBC kind of thing. And then the other movie I saw was called Supernova.
Oh, okay.
And it stars.
That is another blind spot for me.
That's bleaker. And it stars Stanley Tucci and Colin Firth as a gay couple who are on the road in a van. It reminds me a little bit of that movie that Donald Sutherland and Helen Mirren did, where one of them is maybe losing his mind and they're both really smart, sharp, fabulous, clever people. So that's an issue as they, you know, a little bit like Alice. Great, great performances from these two guys. Really good.
Now, do you think it has real awards potential? I mean,
these are both small movies that could have used a festival launch, and they're both being finished late in the day. They're both British-ish, and so they're coming in quietly. And I don't know. It's an interesting time. There's all sorts of opportunities, and some of the late-breaking movies. If they're given enough marketing and enough support, these are both movies that the actors will respond to if they see the movies. Now, the other thing I'm hearing a lot from people, Linda Opes said something on Twitter that I noticed. A lot of people are trying to watch movies and not getting very excited about them. And that's where the critics come in. Circle back to our beginning of the talk we've had today. I think the critics groups are going to allow people to go in the direction of some of the best stuff out there instead of wading through a lot of dross. The Academy portal has like 100 titles and a lot of them are dreck.
Who needs the Academy when you have the critics? Bottom line,
no,
that should
just
be
a
the
commerce.
Real award season.
That's you pay your 25, your $12,500, and you can put your movie on that stupid portal.
Yeah, forget the portal.
And
just wait for the critics.
The screeners are coming in. Nomadland came in.
Yes, I got a very, very beautiful Nomadland DVD. Too bad I've already seen it, so it's kind of a placeholder because I'm not going to be seeing people at holiday parties that I can hand it off to anytime soon.
I know. I used to do a little don't tell anybody, but I used to do a slightly controlled lending library. Oh, no
who
longer.
Doesn't?
No
who
longer.
Doesn't? I miss
not
my
happening.
Shoebox. We keep the shoebox. And then by the time I go to Sundance, my wife would have like a little stack of movies that she needed to keep up with because I'd been talking about them all year and she just like powered through those. harder with the links. So that's something to think about. In any case, Anne, I will see you next week. We will have plenty to talk about then, and I cannot wait. So have a good one.
I'm looking forward to seeing you at the holiday party later.
Oh, yes, that too. Off the record.
Bye.
Bye.